Welcome. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM, and on the web at www.cjsf.ca. This is Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
Vous écoutez Latin Waves sur CJSF 90.1 FM.
Están en sintonía de CJSF 90.1 FM. Este es su programa Latin Waves. Welcome to today's edition of Latin Waves. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM, on the web www.cjsf.ca. We are privileged today to have Mark Becker. He is our guest. He's a professor at Truman State University. He teaches Latin American history. He's also the author of Indians and Leftists in the Making of Ecuador's Modern Indigenous Movement, published by Duke Publishing in 2008. And he's the founder of Native Web, the premier website on indigenous peoples around the world. Welcome to our show, Mark.
Good morning. Happy to be with you.
Thank you for joining us. Now, I wanted to thank you so much for joining us. Your book is a great interest to me as it speaks to the importance of alliances between rural indigenous and urban leftist activists. First of all, let's start by talk a little bit about your book and what is the significance or the important role that this alliance has had in Ecuador.
The book is a history of how Ecuador developed one of the strongest social movements in the 20th century. In 1990, there was a massive indigenous uprising that fundamentally shifted in Ecuador how people viewed the role of ethnic politics, and it put a population that historically had been marginalized and dispossessed into the center of political events. And it was an uprising for a lot of us that really grabbed our attention on a variety of levels. This came right in the aftermath of the defeat of the Sandinistas in Nicaragua, a leftist government. And for a lot of us, there seemed to be this a closing of spaces for those of us who wanted to make a new and better world. And then this movement seemed to come out of nowhere, and it drew a lot of our attention to what was happening with indigenous peoples. This was right on the eve of the quincentennial, the 500th anniversary of Columbus's voyage across the Atlantic, and so a lot of us began paying attention to what was happening in Ecuador, and I went there and started to study this. And the deeper I studied it, the more I began to realize that there was a much deeper history here in Ecuador than I realized, and really across the Americas, of people organizing for social change, and that this movement in 1990 was a very important uprising, very important movement, but it didn't come out of nowhere. It came out of really a century of people deliberately, collaboratively organizing together around common issues and really around very concrete issues. I see really the Great Depression as being a watershed where it illustrated to us that there was emerging a new economic system that benefited a small wealthy elite but didn't benefit the rest of us. And the more I studied this, the more I grew up on a farm in South Dakota, and I began to realize that these economic changes sweeping Ecuador in the 1920s, particularly the agricultural economy, were very similar to what my family had experienced in the 1920s and 1930s in South Dakota, and how these broader economic changes aren't isolated to one country, but are illustrative of what was happening around the world. And I've subsequently just become fascinated by social movement organizing in Ecuador, and I really learned a lot about how to organize here in North America by watching how people are successful and what problems they run into in Ecuador.
Now, one of the, I think that your point is very valid when you talk about how the Depression was sort of this watershed moment. Some people have described it as the revolution. Capitalism has been the revolution of the rich in terms of the level of displacement that has taken place among poor people. We interviewed John Gibler last week, and he was talking about this idea of conquest. And he says, you know, the conquest is ongoing. It's ongoing in the sense that when we try to teach in our schools that the lands were discovered, they were settled, and close the book, it has been ended. In your book, you actually talk about the uprisings of indigenous people and this ongoing uprising and the role that women have taken in terms of having leadership role in these revolutionary movements. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, we have this picture of the European conquest of the Americas being a really quick event, and that it's over, and like you say, it's really an ongoing event. And one of the places where it's most obvious, I think, is among the Maya people in Guatemala and Mexico, where there's probably no less than 5 points over the last 500 years where historians will point to that this was like the definitive conquest of the Mayas, and yet they keep coming back. The last in 1994 with the Zapatista uprising, here in Ecuador, it's a similar type of history, where a marginalized population that historians say is not is basically part of the past. They keep coming back, and what strikes me about the role of how indigenous leaders and intellectuals conceptualize the struggle in Ecuador, it's not like they're holding on to the past. And I think that's often leads to failure if you try to hold on to the past. But they have this idea of Pachakutik, which I never completely know how to translate it, but it's kind of like a return to the future. It's like taking the things from the past that are valuable and using those to develop a better future, and so it's a very forward-looking movement, recognizing what's valuable in the past and moving forward. And the role of women in Ecuador, I find just absolutely fascinating, because we talk about triple exploitation or quadruple exploitation. One of the key players in my book is a woman named Dolores Kakwango, who was an indigenous Quechua woman. So, I mean, in terms of thinking of triple exploitation, she was Indian, she was a woman, she was poor, and normally we'd look at her and say, this is not somebody with a lot of resources, but yet she didn't know how to read or write. But one thing that I begin to realize is in a written culture, we really lose our oral capacities, and she memorized things like the labor code and could cite that back when people would challenge her on points, and just an incredible organizer. And it's amazing to show up at indigenous movements meetings today, and people will stand up and say, look, we have all of these resources, everything in favor of us, but still we can't organize ourselves as well as Dolores Kakwango did 50 or 100 years ago, and she had really no resources. And the other thing that really amazes me about people like Dolores Kakwango, in many ways it's the reverse of what we would stereotypically think of as maybe as a Che Guevara young guerrilla leader, somebody who's male, often unattached, has nothing to lose, and so is willing to risk everything because there is really nothing to lose. But Dolores Kakwango was a grandmother when she was doing a lot of this with a family, and really in a lot of ways maybe everything to lose, but also everything to gain. And I think that's part of what motivated her, was this idea that she had lived oppression, exclusion. Asian racism and didn't want her descendants to live through the same thing, and so was really motivated to organize her community and to try to build a better future.
That's a beautiful story. I think that that's such an important story to share because I often challenge students in class, and I said, you know, we have all the resources. Why is it that we have the dream that something better must be possible? Why is it that we can't act on those ideals, right? And a lot of it is this idea, as you said, that, you know, people who take those risks is because they have nothing to lose. I mean, of course they're going to do that because they have nothing to lose, but you're right, they also have everything to gain. What are some of the connections you make? In your book, you talk about leftists, the Indians and leftists in the making of a modern indigenous movement. What role do progressive people play in being part? Because I think that sometimes we have in the North the idea that we have to go there and tell them how they need to organize, how they need to do things. How do you see the role of people, or perhaps maybe ours is just one of getting inspiration and doing something similar in our own land? What do you draw from this experience?
Yeah, I call these modern movements because, and I point to this really to the emergence of capitalism in the 1920s, where the focus of indigenous movements, indigenous uprisings, goes back to the conquest. And I would argue in Ecuador goes back before before the Spanish conquest, because they were also fighting the Inca conquest and a long fight against imperialism. But often it was a struggle that was narrowly conceptualized. I am working for a landholder. The landholder exploits me. I kill the landholder, but nothing changes structurally. The landholder's brother comes in. The structures stay the same. The repression gets worse, and you haven't achieved anything. And what I'm looking at in the 1920s is a period where people begin to assume a structural knowledge and awareness of their exploitation and the nature of the changes that have to happen, that these aren't local changes, these are global changes. And this is my argument in the book, that one of the reasons why these movements in Ecuador gain success is because they make these coalitions, because they make these linkages, and furthermore they tend to be horizontal, not vertical linkages. So it's not like outsider do-gooders coming in and saying, you know, I'm going to help you, I'm going to save you, but rather it's building these collaborations with looking specifically at rural Indian activists and urban activists, and I hesitate to talk about urban leftists and rural Indians, because in many ways that sets up a false dichotomy, because increasingly the Indians are leftists too. They become members of the socialist and communist parties. They're actively engaged with organizing these types of movements. And one thing that I begin to see too is that the Indians begin to Indianize them, or urban movements, to bring these part of the cosmology of community, a deeper sense of struggle, of the types of world we want to implement. The way it's talked about currently in Ecuador is a plurinationalism. I mean, the Zapatistas in Mexico talk about a world in which there's space for all of us, and this is basically what they're talking about in Ecuador. But plurinationalism does not mean just indigenous nations, but it means reconceptualizing the state so there's room for all of us, all of our ideas. And concretely, I think there's really important exchanges that happen, that the socialists, urban socialists, and these are often educated professional lawyers, they bring in skill sets that the Indians don't have and that they need in terms of helping to design petitions, of drawing up legal cases, and also sometimes on a very practical level of creating things like propaganda of handbills that they pass around to spread awareness of meetings, for example. And so this type of technical support really helps spread the visibility and viability of indigenous movements.
One of the I was recently attending a discussion on Gaza and Palestine, and my friend and one of the women there said, you know, well, it's fine to talk about Gaza, she says, but let's face it, you know, there's killing and displacement everywhere. Look at the indigenous people here. We've been displacing them. We've got no interest in making settlements. So what about that? And the speaker said, you know, you make a very good point. Until we address the issue of colonization, this ongoing colonization and the racism that is inherent in that, we can't, in all good faith, move to a place of creating a world that's more egalitarian. How do we bridge that gap? How do we bring people to even discuss these issues?
You know, the one thing that I have learned in watching how, more broadly, how indigenous movements are organizing themselves across Latin America, and there's really the emergence of, right now, of a fairly strong pan-Latin American indigenous movement. One thing I've learned is that I'm really clueless about how to organize, and it really, relatively speaking, I'm talking about that. I think that we have so much to learn, and for that reason, I don't know that I'm the best person to put forward solutions. I feel like I'm very much a student rather than a teacher when it comes to looking at how to solve these problems.
In your book, you do speak about this idea of indigenous people sort of transcending the idea that there is a class struggle outside and then there is an issue that is, and rather making those connections. How do we, is it necessary to have that discussion in terms of understanding the class struggle that still permeates our discourse and still... The reason I ask this is because I think that if we achieve political power without any kind of economic power or any kind of resource, access to resources, then it's meaningless. Do you see that correlation, and how do we correct it?
Yeah, the one thing that I have learned is when I started these studies, I was going into it with the question of whether... the exploitation I was observing in Ecuador was ethnic or class based. Was this racial exploitation or was this economic exploitation? And the more I've studied this, the more I realize that this is completely a false dichotomy. It's a type of divisions, and subsequently, it's something I like to talk to social movement activists across Latin America. It's these type of academic divisions that we create in the classroom. That if all of us always juggle multiple types of identities, and so the talking about a race versus class division is not something that exists in the real world, and I would say a corollary of that too is perhaps what's more interesting is how race and class exploitation tend to feed off of each other, and interact with each other. And then another corollary would be that in looking at people's awareness of exploitation, if I'm aware of racial exploitation, for example, that does not make me less aware of other types of exploitation, you know, whether it's class, whether it's whether it's gender, whether it's anything else. But in fact, awareness of one type of exploitation would tend to make me aware of other types of exploitation. And I think this is one thing that I see within the leftist movements in Ecuador, is that the urban Marxists perhaps were coming out of more of an awareness of of a class exploitation, but as they work increasingly with indigenous communities, they gain a much more sophisticated understanding of how this intersects with the racial structures in society, and they really emerge as leaders against racial exploitation and other forms of exploitation. And I think that they really come to a rather sophisticated sense of that there's a that we can't just address one type of exploitation at a time. We need to address all forms of exploitation, and I would argue we need to address all forms of exploitation, no matter where it occurs, whether it's in Palestine, whether it's in Darfur, on a global level. And I think it's that type of awareness and addressing those issues on a really on a global level that increasingly makes indigenous movements so powerful and so successful in Latin America.
We are talking with Mark Becker. He is our guest this morning. He's a professor at Truman State University and the author of Indians and Leftists in the Making of Ecuador's Modern Indigenous Movement. You're also the founder of Native Web, the premier website of indigenous people around the world. Can you talk a little bit about this, the website?
Yeah, this is something that we started in the early 90s, and at that point I was an intern with a group in Oakland, California called the South and Mesoamerican Indian Rights Center, known by its acronym SAIC, and it was designed to build international solidarity, and particularly in the United States for first South American and then Pan-American indigenous movements. And and SAIC was an important point of departure in terms of building these international alliances in a pan-indigenous movement as it emerged in the 1990s. Native Web emerged out of that idea. The idea was to have, and a lot of things have changed in the 15, 20 years since then. And at that point, there was a lot of marginalization in terms of the digital divide, people not having access to the resources to use the internet, and so our idea was to use this new emerging technology in order to create spaces to advance indigenous struggles, and I think in that we were very successful, and that indigenous movements became innovators in terms of using electronic technology to advance their struggles, and it was rather interesting because there's people who would adhere to this notion of a noble savage, that if an Indian uses technology, somehow that Indian is less pure, less ethnic, and that, you know, they should stay away from technology because it has a corrupting influence. And in a lot of ways, I'm a Luddite. I'm very aware of the negative, how technology can be alienating, and that it can damage community. But also, I think that if properly used, and that's always our struggle, is to use it properly, that it can really facilitate the building of community. And so that's one of the things that we were trying to do, to raise awareness, to build these linkages, and to build a more just world.
What are some of the projects that are being promoted presently? Are there any projects that people can participate or that can connect people worldwide on this move to acknowledge, the indigenous struggle and to align our own struggles for more just access to employment, resources, clean air, clean water?
Yeah, particularly with the Hemispheric Indigenous Movement, there's going to be in at the end of May of this year, 2009, in Peru. There's the fourth summit of indigenous continental indigenous movements, and this is something that has largely emerged out of South and Central America, And we're working to try to make people here in the North more aware of this, particularly in Indigenous communities. And so, particularly for Indigenous communities to make these hemispheric connections, I think is important. And that's one thing that we're trying to facilitate. More broadly, particularly in South America, a lot of movements talk about neoliberalism. This is a struggle against neoliberalism, which is, in a very tight nutshell, that's a gloss for capitalism, saying that we're facing an economic system that exploits the majority of us in order to benefit a very small elite. And as the economic system collapses, I think we begin to be aware of that. And particularly in these struggles against this type of an economic system, against environmental collapse, these are much broader struggles that I think we need to work together in order to gain success, and that the more we work together, the more successful we are in terms of gaining solutions. So increasingly, some of this organization happens in venues like the World Social Forum. I just returned from a couple of weeks ago from Belém, Brazil, where it was the 9th annual meeting of the World Social Forum that had a large Indigenous presence. And then the Indigenous gathering there was talking adamantly about the crisis of civilization, the crisis of Western civilization, and the need to build alternative models. And this idea of if we don't build alternative models, the society in which we live is going to die. And so this is that it's adamantly important that we build a new and better model so that we can survive.
It's beautiful. One of the ways that I think it's always important to remember is that change begins where you are. You know, when we're all working to create more just spaces, you know, whether it's in our own community, being aware of policies that are displacing people. Here in BC, for instance, we have a huge move to privatize rivers in BC. The government has been giving away some of the rivers, and you know, being present, you know, at the moment when those things are happening, I think carries a lot of weight. You've explained some of the ways in which Indigenous people are fighting their struggle, but I wonder how has the drive to privatize water and particularly united movements of Indigenous people throughout Latin America that may have been distinct?
Yeah, water, like a lot of these struggles, I think has a much longer history than many people realize, because we can go back in historical documents and I mean, speaking specifically in the case of Ecuador that I know best, there have long been struggles over irrigation, for example. Who has the rights to access water, and how is that water going to be used? Because if communities have access to it, they use it for agriculture. If industries have access to water, they pollute it, and there are very different versions of whether this is a commodity or whether this is something that's important for human existence. And you know, a lot of people are observing now that water wars are going to be much more important than oil wars, because we can live without petroleum, we can't live without water, and increasingly there's corporations who are recognizing this and are trying to privatize and control water, and this isn't something that's happening just in one area, but happening on a global level with global ramifications, and arguably the struggle for a clean, secure supply of water is one of the most important struggles that we're facing today.
How do people get access to your book? How do people get in touch with you for more information on your website?
Perhaps the easiest way is just to go to my website, which is Yachana, which is spelled Y-A-C-H-A-N-A And I have on the website, there's a link that's called Research, and if you click on the Research, you'll find it takes you to where my book and my academic publications are. And I also have an Ecuador section on there where I have more information on these movements and my historical studies in Ecuador. And there's an About Me link where I have information on some of these social movement organizings, particularly my involvement with World Social Forums and with the Hemispheric Indigenous Movement Organizing.
Thank you so much for being with us. Mark Becker is my guest. He is a professor at Truman State University. He teaches Latin American history, and he is the author of Indians and Leftists in the Making of Ecuador's Modern Indigenous Movement, which was published in 2008. He's also the founder of Native Web, the premier website of indigenous people around the world. We've reached him in the States. I'm not sure where exactly you are, but thank you.
I'm in Madison, snowy Madison, Wisconsin right now.
Thank you so much, and thank you for all your involvement. Now, in closing, what inspires you to keep fighting? Why should people get off their couch and turn off the TV and strive, participate in some way to create a different world?
That's a much broader question, and I don't know if I can explain it in a nutshell, but I come out of the Radical Reformation, out of an Anabaptist family with a 500-year history of recognizing that we need to treat people as of the fundamental importance and the importance of making a more just, more safe world. And this importance of the rights of people and making a society where all of us have these rights to live and thrive. And so it's a cosmology that puts the importance of social justice at the center. That's the most important thing. And so for me, it's a very deep personal motivation that comes out of my own family history.
Thank you so much for joining us, Mark.
Okay, thank you. Happy to talk to you.
By the way, I'm dedicating this song to you. It's from the World March for Peace. It's called Give Peace a Chance.
Oh, great, thanks.
Take care.
Alcemos la voz en un canto en favor de la paz. Alcemos la voz en un canto en favor de la paz. Alcemos la voz en un canto en favor de la paz, porque con hambre e injusticia no se puede encontrar. Alcemos la voz en un canto en favor de la paz. Alcemos la voz en un canto en favor de la paz. Alcemos la voz.